I said on the first night that Paul had, I think in his mind, warned me that coming and doing a class at Holden Village, that what people who attended really wanted was for me to talk for maybe 5 minutes and then shut up so the rest of you can talk. And tonight, I'm really counting on that. You know, the topic is humans' dominion over the earth. What does it mean today? And that, for me, is a thinly disguised way of talking about the ecology, where we are with climate change, energy policy, all this kind of stuff. So I really don't have any prepared remarks that I want to give, other than to say, if I'd been doing this 5 years ago, I wouldn't feel nearly as concerned as I do today. At Augustana College, we have something called the last lecture, which, if any of you are familiar with that tradition in college, traditionally it's been for professors who are retiring or about to die. Fortunately, at Augustana, it's a little different. The seniors vote on three or four professors that they'd like to hear something from. And I was fortunate enough to be asked to do that last year, which was a little strange because I was on sabbatical the whole year. I wasn't around, and I got selected for this, and I figure maybe it was the fact that I was gone that they were willing to listen to me. But the talk that I gave that night was basically to challenge the seniors by saying, our generation, and except for some of you sitting up on the balcony, I think I can include just about everybody down here, our generation has done an admirable job of screwing up the planet and screwing up just about everything that we've laid our hands on. And if we're going to continue to exist on Earth, it's going to be up to you guys to fix the problems that we've made. And so I have this feeling that it's a lot more urgent that we do something about this. I have that feeling now that I didn't have 5 or 10 years ago. So that's where I'm coming from. I came in and jotted some notes down before you all came in. Oh, I even get the change too. Wow. Thank you. I just jotted some notes down about ways we might approach this. I do think we ought to talk about this idea of dominion, what it means, what it meant when it was written, what it might mean today. There's a book that Daniel Corton wrote probably 10 or 15 years ago or so now, called When Corporations Rule the World. And in it, he has a chapter where he talks about cowboy environments versus astronaut environments. The idea being that when cowboys were in the wild, wild west, they could use whatever resources there were. They didn't have to worry about throwing trash away, anything like that. When you're an astronaut on a spaceship, it's an entirely different situation. You have to carefully ration the resources you have. You have to recycle everything. And so that may be an interesting way of thinking, an interesting analogy about thinking of the way that what we're faced with on Earth. You know, then there's all kinds of specific topics that we can talk about there. Another one that I hesitate to put down, but if you're interested in it, we can talk about it, is economic systems. We operate under a capitalistic economic system, which has done a fabulous job of raising living standards in this country, at least material living standards. It's also done a fabulous job of raping the environment. So there may be some things that we could talk about there. Any of those ideas strike you? Anything that you get revved up about that we ought to jump on? If not, I think the default is to talk about the Dominion question and what that means. So let's start there.
Great call. I'll ask everybody in here a question. In whatever discipline you are specifically involved in, or we are, including myself, does anybody in your discipline, in your area of interest or profession, talk about population?
It's an incredibly good question. The actuary in the back.
Yeah.
That's their whole life.
Well, we talk about it in terms of how it impacts our school and our school district, but I don't think we ever talked about it, how it impacts the world.
Even that, though, they do.
We're definitely talking frequently about population because the population in McMinnville is changing dramatically to Latino. So we're trying to accommodate that at high school, and the town's growing. And, you know, so we talk a lot about local population in my job.
But in terms of race and ethnicity, or in terms of number?
Both number, but also meeting the needs of, you know, right now we're 32% Latino, and the elementary is coming up in a couple of years, we'll be 40% Latino at the high school, and so, you know, we're wanting to get us trained in some we've got a pretty good ELL situation, but we want to just make sure we're really reaching those needs and not having them separate from the regular population, blending them together into all the classrooms, and just a lot of strategies to make that, learn the culture and make them comfortable with the rest of us white
people. Oh, if I could jump in there, I want to ask you college students, I've gotten most of you up there. Do the letters ZPG mean anything to you?
Never heard of it.
Okay, oldsters, what is ZPG?
Zero Population Growth.
What has happened to that movement?
Yeah.
15 years ago, that was a real concern, something that we talked about a lot. And it's gone now.
Good.
Why?
Why?
Because what I understood about it was zero population growth was a catchphrase that was used to bring about policies of population control. It was used in academia or politics or government or anything as a catch-all to kind of smooth it over. But what I find, what I came to understand about it was China's population control policies, as an example, and it being disguised even within the United States government and local governments, whether it's county, city, state, people adopting very similar policies but calling it something different and disguising it with zero population growth. So as I understood it, it was a very dark thing that was...
So your concern with it was in terms of individual liberty?
Yes.
Of having how many children you want?
Not necessarily reproductive rights, but governments disguising human control over God's control of everything, and glossing it over with a catchphrase of zero population growth.
I think sort of in some ways that the opposite thing happened. It became politically sort of a hot potato where conservatives looked at it as, I sort of lost my train of thought, but of not disallowing discussions of population control.
Right.
So that when the Red Cross went into a certain country, they couldn't talk about ways of not getting pregnant, they couldn't talk about birth control, they
right.
couldn't talk about all those sort of things. But that wasn't for zero population growth, it was exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
So none of our funding will go to any program that will deal with birth control of any sort.
And
so it's sort of, that was your impression of zero population growth.
Yeah,
certainly morphed into something very different.
That's what it did too, or that's what I understand now, is in the time when we used to talk about it and when it was a catchphrase, it was something that was lauded, but it's also was a wonderful tool for exposing those kind of bad policies and destroying what I understand, destroying a lot of those ideas of population control and other things. Like, nobody wants to talk about it anymore because we exposed it for something completely different.
Larry?
Well, for reasons that I'm not really clear
can
about.
Can you speak up a little more?
You've got people right above you. For reasons that I'm not really clear about, the subject might not be hotly debated because a large number of countries in Europe have negative population growth, big time. Italy is a startling example. And as a result, they've begun to have significant immigration problems because they need immigrants to run the industry, to run businesses. America, on the other hand, has continued its flow of immigrants, legally or illegally, and we have a very healthy population. It's not growing out of, you know, wildly out of size, but it's slightly positive growth rate, if I'm not mistaken. And so you, if you've got that going on in all of the well-to-do Western countries who would be prone to popularizing and advertising and promoting and funding that activity, it's a dead issue. Of course, the whole rest of the world has population problems, but they don't, you know, they're not on the list.
Wasn't a part of the problem then also that there was sort of a subtext of racism, ethnic kind of stuff, wanting these other people to limit their growth so that we didn't slip from 6% to 5% to 4% to 3%, whatever.
And so it became a political hot potato then. Yes, ma'am, and then?
I'm a global studies major, and in my classes that we've been taking, we did talk about population, and like you notice when they talk about like overpopulation, it's only like developing countries mostly. It kind of blinds you to the fact that like a lot of the problems are due to like, you know, like the distribution of resources. So I feel like focusing on population sort of blinds you from like the real problems actually.
And what would some of those real problems be?
We studied Egypt for one thing, and they were saying, well, there's so many people in this one area, but it was really that there were large farm owners, and so people were being pushed off their land, and so it was more of an issue of the resources, like not being shared equally.
Okay.
Well, I think at the Beijing Women's Conference a few years ago, one of the main things that came out of that was that women who are educated, actually that tends to decrease population. When women have a choice, when they become more educated, that lowers population. It's countries that have where women are less educated or where there's a great need, where there's not a social economic safety net, where population growths are booming. And we've adopted two kids from the Philippines, which has an average of 6 kids per family. And I guess we have a negative population growth in our family, I guess, because we've adopted two kids and haven't added any to the end of the world. But
by the way, if your younger daughter disappears, you'll know where she is, okay?
It's fun. But I guess it becomes so important for us, not just to have a zero or a negative population growth, but to teach them in this country that uses 75% of the wealth, 25% of the less than 25% of the population, to teach them how to be good stewards of the earth. Not just to not have negative growth or even growth, but to teach our kids in this country how to be good stewards. That's much more important, I think, than population growth.
Well, I'd agree with you to a point, but I did want to bring up something that I learned doing some research on the DuPont Chemical Corporation. For those of you who don't know, DuPont makes some of the most dangerous chemicals around, and they have the best industrial safety record for their workers of any company in the United States. And you would think, if they manufacture dangerous chemicals, they're going to have more industrial accidents and worker injuries and deaths and all of that. And they don't. And part of the research that I was doing was trying to find out why that was the case. And, I mean, they do all kinds of things, you know, in terms of incentivizing employees not to have accidents and all that kind of stuff. But one of the things that struck me the most is what they call root cause failure analysis, which has a really cool sounding name to it. But it's very simple. If something happens, if an industrial accident happens, the first thing that DuPont will do is have counsel that gets together to investigate the accident. And of course, they don't talk about accidents because accidents should never happen and all that. But the point of root cause failure analysis is to ask the question why something happened and to keep going back further and further until you get to the root cause. So the example that I use when I talk with students about this to kind of explain how it works. Let's assume that a vat of sulfuric acid is in a warehouse, and it's up on a scaffolding 10 feet high, and something happens and the vat of sulfuric acid turns over and falls on somebody. And then you've got the Wicked Witch of the West happen. They just melt on the floor. Vivid examples stick with students, okay? And I always pick somebody out that gets melted so they remember it even better. Well, the easy answer to the cause of this accident is that the vat of sulfuric acid tipped over. That's what happened, right? But if you ask why, well, because it was up on a scaffold 10 feet in the air. Why would you store a vat of acid 10 feet in the air on a scaffold? Well, because the warehouse was full and we had to raise something up because we didn't have any more floor space. Well, why is the warehouse full? Because we have all kinds of hula hoops that we haven't sold yet. Why do we have hula hoops? Because our marketing person doesn't know what the heck they're doing. So in this silly example, what we find is that the root cause of this industrial accident is poor marketing practices. And so rather than fire the warehouse manager, what you ought to do is be firing the marketing director and getting somebody who knows that hula hoops don't sell anymore. So the point with this, the reason I'm bringing it up now, is as we think about all of these issues that we have in terms of our ecology, my guess is, and I've never done this formally, but my guess is if you do this root cause analysis, pretty much all of it comes back to population. If we still had 1 billion people in the world, we probably wouldn't be worrying so much about water rights like John talked about this afternoon. We wouldn't be running out of oil so quickly. There'd be a lot of pressures that we have now that would be alleviated. That, to me, is the reason to talk about population growth or limiting it. But I think your point about teaching people to be good stewards is critical because our population is growing.
Well, except for a very small portion of the population is eating up a massive amount of resources.
And who would that be?
Some people in some rich countries.
Yeah. Look in the mirror for all of us.
I'm kind of amazed at how little we're willing to sacrifice to make that happen. I mean, if there's any pain at all, people just bitch, yell, and moan. I mean, gas got to $4 a gallon, which it was more than that in England when we were there in 1999, well in excess of $4 a gallon. And we come unglued. But man, at $4 a gallon, people start going, I'm finding the bus.
Right. I was in Turkey a couple of weeks ago and it was $8.40.
Yeah. Wow.
But in other countries, you don't drive to some place for, say, 30 cents on a special.
No, housing was of a 4 and 5 story condo flat kind of thing. And the most curious thing to me would be at 7:30 at night, there were still plenty of parking spaces around that building.
So if population is the root cause of failure, so to speak, then what is the reason for the population growth?
I mean, people hate each other.
I guess people hate each other. But is it economic needs? Then we get into the conversation about economics.
If the jar of fruit flies is half full at 8:59, when will it be full?
Soon. Got me on that one.
It's a great question.
Parish I served, who was going into zoology, and later years he stopped by the house where we were living, but he had to leave because he had to get back to his station at the University of Illinois. This was Richmond, Indiana. And I said, well, what's the urgency? And he gave me that illustration, that if he didn't get back to his laboratory, the fruit fly experiment would go zilch because it would overflow. I don't know what you say. But it was just the idea that, you know, when the population increases to the point that you have twice as many women becoming pregnant, the population growth grows exponentially, not sequentially as we've thought in the past.
Goodness, has helped too. We've kept more people alive longer.
Yes. Well, and birth rate, you know, how many more kids reach the age of 5 than used to.
How many do we keep alive at a birth that we lost years ago?
Well, but here's where we get back into that hot potato issue. As somebody's already pointed out, most of the countries in Western Europe now have negative growth rates. Mm-hmm. I mean, we in the United States, I'm not sure where we are, because we still have
zero.
Are we pretty much at zero?
We're pretty close to zero. Wait,
we're 2.3 with immigrants, and something like 1.9 without.
Okay. And 2.1 is the replacement rate, right?
I think so, yeah. And 1.9 to begin a decline under 1.8, you don't ever recover.
Okay. So the population growth is coming primarily from developing countries. And that's, you know, where we start being the big bully, telling other people how to do things. Larry?
One of the basic problems in population growth is something that was alluded to earlier, and I'll phrase it as women's rights. In so many countries, women have no rights, and they're just property, and all of a sudden you've got all kinds of kids running around. And in some places, it's because they want to run the farm, and there's no social security backup. So one or two of those kids, like down in Paraguay where one of my sons lived, out of the farm, they raise a bunch of kids because at least a couple of the women are going to go into town and be maids for the rest of their life. They are not marriable as far as most men are concerned, and their goal in life is to send money home to support mom and pop until they die. And therein lies one of the bigger problems as far as I'm concerned. And it's really dramatic.
This is my first time at Holton, and I understand that the library is basically brand new in its current state. I spent a lot of time over there, but there's this book is over there, Blessed Unrest by Paul Hawken. I read about half of it yesterday, and it is an incredible book. And one of the points that he makes in here is that ecological concerns and human rights are inseparable, as Larry just pointed out, that much of this comes back to the lack of women's rights in many countries. June? Are you Jean?
June,
I'm sorry. Well, you had a hand up.
Another issue is that when you have such an increase in population, the land on which these poor countries exist eventually reaches a disability to be able to support that amount of people. So compounded the problem of overpopulation so tremendously, so that even health becomes very difficult in getting back to agricultural practices that will be able to be sustainable on a land that's been stripped of all of its nutrients. And I mean, there's just all sorts of problems with overpopulation in any country, really. So land can no longer support it.
Well, the way that I've been talking about population in the last year or so is around Karen's capacity or ability to have enough resource to meet expectations. And we have a situation now where we have, I think the number is 1.2 billion Chinese and Indians who are expecting a different lifestyle, and those countries are accumulating capital at a rate that actually they're going to be able to achieve that lifestyle, which is one that means they have electricity and they have mobility. And and that's going to happen in the next 10 years under current trends, you know, that the demographers are looking at. And the problem, where I've come down on that issue is to get into the solar business and try to substitute carbon-based forms of energy production for renewable, non-carbon-based. Because if 1.2 billion Chinese and Indians start wanting electricity and driving cars, the amount of carbon that's going to get put into the atmosphere is going to be that much faster and exacerbate what I have come to believe is a unsustainable limit that looks like we're going to hit in the next 10 to 15 years in terms of being able to recover some of the climate change issues that are going to come hit us. And but that actually paradoxically helps me in my business, because I'm able to then demonstrate to people that even though solar may cost a little bit more now, if you think electricity costs a lot in this country today, think about what it's going to cost when we're having to compete with China and India and South Africa and Indonesia and a bunch of other countries for fuel sources to power our power plants. And so I'm able to show financial models that say you better diversify away from carbon-based forms. But independent of that issue, talking about population, limiting population growth at this point, it's that horse has left the barn. The biggest problem I think we face is the energy/climate issue, which is that if we don't have a different solution for those 1.2 billion, and I say we, I mean, I don't know how to affect it, but the climate change science indicates that we are on a path that all the rules are rewritten. Everything is, we're starting from scratch in terms of what we're dealing with around water and water availability and climate and what this earth is actually able to support from a carrying capacity standpoint.
Yes, ma'am.
Seems like we're kind of, I suppose because I was framed in that word dominion when I walked in the door, but I mean, we have this dominion over the earth. I guess I think it would be fun to discuss that word. Putting this big ugly black cloud is how I kind of see our dominion of the earth right now.
Okay. Well, I think it's important to talk about that. Is that just an okay time to do that?
Well, I think the point of what I was making is the earth is going to, the idea of us having dominion is going to, that's going to get turned on its head. I mean, we're approaching a period when the notion that we could have dominion, I think, is going to be turned around.
Meaning we won't really have control anymore.
No. The forces, the earth is going to take dominion back. Yeah.
I'd like to throw another twist on that. When you mentioned dominion, for me, that my word is empire.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And empires do not survive. They are not sustainable. So our present empire U.S. or Western world is not sustainable, and until or unless we move to a different form of your stewardship thing, Chris,
right.
Seeing how the world's put together and how we can utilize it, it's not sustainable.
Well, what did God mean when he said we have dominion over the earth?
Different translations don't say dominion.
Yeah, yeah, right.
What
do other stewardship? Stewardship and
care.
Care.
Nurture.
It'd be interesting to know, I don't know if anybody up there does, the history of that translation and the political motive and the cultural motive behind it. I'm not a Hebrew scholar.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to believe that in Genesis, when it talks about having dominion over the earth, that means utilizing resources when you need them. And what I mean by that is when Native Americans lived here, they hunted when they needed to, they gathered wood when they needed to, and they killed animals when they needed to for houses, for huts and for food. But other than that, they didn't destroy or do anything completely unnecessary. And so my point is that having dominion is using resources that the earth provides to the point where we absolutely need them, but not overusing them, if that makes sense.
Not a sense of exploitation.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
Well, I think it's interesting to consider the word, well, someone used expectation, what we expect to be given. And it becomes interesting when compared with your idea of needing things,
mm-hmm.
Because I think those ideas are often intertwined and they should be separated. Because we expect a lot more than we need from the environment. And I think that's one of the biggest problems when people aren't willing to sacrifice their expectations and the population approaches or surpasses the carrying capacity that our Earth can sustain.
Interesting point. Larry,
The raising of the subject of Native American culture is an interesting one because they had a completely different concept. They were of the world, not in the world. We're in the world and have dominion, so to speak. They were of the world. They were a part of this whole matrix, and they treated that matrix as if the same thing could happen to them that they did to the animals in many respects. And so they said thanks when they killed this animal or ate this grain. Part and parcel of how they relate it. We relate totally differently than they did. It's our way of relating to the earth is anathema to the normal Native American original cultures.
Correct me if I'm wrong on this timeline, but what the way I understand it is that Adam was granted dominion over the earth, thus naming everything and all the creatures and everything. And that was given to Adam pre-curse. So the way I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that we no longer have dominion in the original form as was granted by God. We're asked to steward the earth, yes, but to say that we had dominion.
So is your point that the dominion got canceled when Adam got kicked out of Garden of Eden?
Yes.
Okay.
That being my point. If I'm wrong on the timeline, I could be wrong on the timeline, but that's the way I understand
it. I don't think the timeline is so important for me as it is to recognize that we can't take dominion literally and factually if we don't take the evolutionary process of creation literally and factually in the sense of, you know, Adam suddenly here.
Mm-hmm. True.
So that I think even after we get the word, the Hebrew word, translated, it still is in a context as it was when it was first given. So that it needs to have some interpretation now as well as then.
My comment is in response to the Native American discussion going on. One thing, I feel like I identify more with the creation story of many Native American cultures, and the fact a lot of them say that the animals came first and that the people came later, or they refer to two-legged people and four-legged people and, you know, different, putting them in the same category. And one sort of tradition or ceremony that stuck out to me in the, I think it was the Coast Salish of the Northwest, Pacific Northwest, is the salmon, what is it called?
First salmon
ceremony. And then when the first salmon of the season is caught, they do a ceremony and basically thank the salmon for giving itself up to them to be eaten. And I feel like as a Western thinker, I would still think, oh, we caught this fish, we're gonna eat it. But it's just that different attitude and that graciousness that I feel makes a difference and makes you question what you really need, and not only what you need, but how is it affecting other people or other animals or other plants. And I think that's something that we're definitely lacking, is just a, I mean, if we had a ceremony about everything we ate, and said, thank you, tree, for giving me this fruit, or thank you. You would really, of course, we don't have time to stop and think about that, but it would really change the way we eat and waste. Not that we have to have a ceremony, but.
Well, but I'd also point out that how we spend our time is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, we've all chosen to take a week or more out of our lives to be here. And I know for myself, I find myself having lots more time to think about things than I normally do. Paul, you did, or Jean, I'm sorry.
It seems to me one of the problems is that the rest of the world wants to have a lifestyle and a standard of living like we do. I've been in China twice, and we were there not long ago, and just in Beijing alone, there were 2,000 cars a day added to that population. It's already unbelievably overcrowded. I think it's hard for us even to imagine. We think about population control and how it might be bad and rights and so on, but you go to a country that has that many people in it and you realize why they have to have the one child. And you realize that adding 2,000 cars a day just in that city that is already crowded, that is already polluted, that doesn't have room for garages and cars, but they want the standard of living that we have in America. It's a disaster. Waiting, building.
Okay. Yes.
I think that you mentioned the word choice, and I think that this discussion is interesting, particularly because we think about these things, but we don't have a choice in it. So all of the actions and all of the decisions that we make have repercussions, both specifically on the earth. So the clothes that we choose to buy, the food that we choose to eat, the cars that we choose to drive, even the way that we walk outside or camp outside has repercussions, whether or not we choose to be involved in that. We talked a lot about community in a discussion like this, and how we can choose to be involved or not involved in specific communities where we live, but in the sense of the earth or the ecology or the ecosystem of the community, their community as the ecosystem, you don't have a choice. So the way you live affects that whole system, whether or not you want it to or not.
Expand on what you mean by we don't have a choice.
Well, so let's say a car, for example, or the transportation in general. The way that you choose to move yourself has an effect on the ecosystem around you. So whether that's on a macro scale in that it puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and increases the temperature, that's on a big scale. But it also, how do you, when you drive on a road, do you affect the ecosystem by using that road, whether you're killing deer with your car or that type of thing. Even just by being, my point is, by being present in the ecosystem, you are a part of it, whether or not you want to be, by simply being there. And so all of the decisions you make may have an effect on that ecosystem, whether positive or negative. And so I think that the conversation about, you know, thanking the salmon for letting us catch them, or choosing the food that we eat, whether it's good or bad, it still has an effect. And so there's no, you have to be involved, and in order to sustain your own self, you have to be a part of that ecosystem or that community.
Which I think is really important. What it seems to me like you're talking about is the interconnectedness mm-hmm. of everything. And by the fact that we live, we are affecting the rest of the environment around us. And it seems to me we've done a pretty lousy job so far of recognizing that.
I think what you're talking about is raising the level of awareness, or like moving to a higher consciousness as far as that interconnectedness or cause and effect. And I think that that's something that's sort of awakening right now. I don't know how many of you have read A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle. Anybody in here? A couple people. So it talks about awakening and just being very present in the moment and evaluating your actions and the repercussions and what you talked about, the cause and effect and finding the root cause of things and just being very aware. And sometimes awareness is the answer. Once you really acknowledge what you're doing and really acknowledge and sit with your effect on the earth and these resources, somehow the answer presents itself to you.
But let me put a question to you that should be near and dear to all of your hearts. What was your carbon footprint in getting here?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question being at Holden Village is a wonderful thing. But I flew from Illinois to Seattle, drove car around for a week, and then came down here and got on the boat. I did a lot of environmental damage getting here. I'm sure most of us did.
So why don't we just stay here and not go home?
Good idea.
Yeah. When I was like thinking of like Dominion, I see it as, you know, like as like care for nature and you know, like not using more than what the earth can sustain. And I think in like our, you know, capitalist consumer culture, we're so like we're really apart from where everything comes from. So I, you know, like a lot of like things come packaged foods. You don't really think about, unless you like purposely think about where your things are coming from. I feel like society at large hasn't yet really realized, you know, where things are coming from, because we're just so far removed from the source now.
Just expanding on that, I don't know, there's a show not too long ago, Jamie Oliver's Food Revolution, and one of the episodes he actually went into the classroom and just held up different vegetables, asked the kids what they were. Dead silence the entire time. He started handing up, holding up fast food, like French fries. They immediately knew what that was. He held the two up next to them, and they were shocked that it was the same thing. Like the potato and the French fries next to each other. They're absolutely shocked that it was the same thing. And then there's kids who, like, I mean, there's even people my age that if you ask them where milk comes from, they say the grocery store. And it to me, that's something that's really frightening, that there's that much of a disconnect between people and where what they use actually comes from.
Yes,
I think it's useful to talk about the word dominion. I mean, a couple of words that come to mind out of that. One of them is the word dominate. Seems to me we've done a pretty good job of. Another, it's a root word, I think, for domine, which is Latin for Lord. And the Adam and Eve story is one in which Adam and Eve are tempted by the serpent to say, you know, if you eat, you won't die. You'll become like God. And Adam and Eve decide, you know, being God must mean being able to dominate, and we'd like to we'd rather be a god than have one. But we are dealing with a god whose choice is not to dominate us, but to love us. And I don't think we've picked that part of it up all that well. We still think God wants to dominate, and I don't think God wants to dominate. And,
the Russian novelist Tolstoy he has a very short book called How Then Do I Live? And I hear Rick talk about the expectations we have, and Ginny talk about 2,000 cars. That's just Beijing. There's a lot of cities in China that I think. The expectations we have, and then I think of a statistic I know. It takes 42,000 liters of water to create 1 kilo of beef. When we know that, how then do I live? When we know that our demands are, I got to get to Spokane in 3 days, so I got to drive 80 miles an hour on a highway that takes 500 feet of, you get the point. How then do I live? I would say most of us don't change the way we live. And I'm just finishing a book called Bottle Mania. And the lengths that we go to, that I was never conscious of, I suspect none of us are, that we go to have water the way we want it, are unbelievable. In terms of chemicals, in terms of land exploitation, in terms of aquifer exploitation, in terms of labor exploitation, and in terms of environmental pollution to get the plastic bottle to put the water in. And on it goes. But we expect that. And I don't know, I just keep living with that question with Tolstoy. How then do I live?
But the beautiful thing about what you just said is that every freshman at Augustana has to read this book. And educating at 19, hopefully you then hope that it changes them.
I just have to pick up again. You introduced things this evening with that sense of urgency you had that was greater than 5 years ago. And I think of the kinds of things that you were talking about, and at the risk of making some inappropriate connection, I think we're living with the possibility of another BP in the Gulf.
We are.
And so, I think about how I consciously try to live these personal kinds of things that we've been talking about. But then, you come along and raise the question about what I did to get here. And then you say we don't basically change our lifestyle. It's surely an interconnected kind of thing. But I guess the thing that bothers me most of all is that we're living that root cause thing with the potential of disasters all over the place, whether it's water or energy or population or government or whatever. And we have to, in changing our attitude, we have to live with that concern about the disaster.
Well, I've been thinking about, I'm sorry, did you?
No, go ahead.
I've been, for those of you who've been doing the Bible study, today Peter talked about the fact that in that Holy Week period, when the disciples were all of a sudden starting to get it, that you're going to die. This is about dying. And it's, we can't kind of sidestep the change, right? And he was talking about death, and then metaphorically, it's not just about the physical death, but all the fundamental change.
Go back to reuse and Coke bottles.
We're going to have, there is fundamental change that you do have to come to, and the kind of, empathy that Jesus had for the struggle that his disciples were going through, to kind of come to terms with the fact that this is a big change. This is not like, I'm going to shop at Whole Foods rather than whatever. I mean, it's a big change. And so when I kind of talk out the disaster scenario, I'm not doing that to say, well, throw up your hands. I'm talking it out because for me,
it helps me change when I get serious about the depth of it. And my hope is around the fact that I think that, in fact, the Earth, wherever that guy went, I think the Earth is going to be making us aware.
It already is, right?
The Earth is sending us messages, and we are going to reconnect, and we are going to, I think we are going to, by necessity, come to terms with the fact that we do have to say a blessing every time we receive our food, and we receive clean water, and whatever, because the Earth is going to be sending us, we've gotten into this place where that is going to happen. So, you know, and to the extent that we as teachers can help prepare ourselves and the others around us to figure out, okay, how do we begin to make those changes as if it really mattered? It really matters. It's not just, you're going to slip into Jerusalem, you're going to make your thing, you're going to tell your message, and then you're going to slip out, and you know, and hopefully, you know, things will be better. But that it's really going to be different now. That's the period we're emerging into.
Yes?
Oh, I was just going to say, this kind of brings up in my mind, I have this problem with the word dominion, because to me, that implies kind of being removed from the system, looking down upon it, you know, and kind of controlling it and taking what you need from it. And this sort of sense of awakening, like the Earth kind of overturning this stuff on us, is making me think that we actually are a part of everything and not, and so dominion to me, I don't know, I just really don't think that that word is maybe the correct translation or not for me. And maybe stewardship or care or something like that is more appropriate. And also I think that then will make us take better care of things, because when you're a part of something, you can't afford to trash it, you know?
And so you're saying the word dominion implies a separateness.
Right, versus being from the rest amidst of yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me ask, Paul, you brought up the different translations earlier for the word dominion. How popular is the translation dominion versus those others? I mean, I am no biblical scholar, but what I always hear is the word dominion. Mm-hmm. Is that the popular translation?
Oh, it's a long-standing kind of
long-standing.
Going back to King James.
Certainly changing, though, don't you think?
Yes. Because there are so many more translations now.
Subdue is another word that's sometimes used.
Well, that would be a good one.
The what?
Subdue. So, we've got a bunch of people who want to talk. Let me, you, and Paul.
Well, there's a movement in the United States, very popular, that we should destroy the Earth, right? Because it will hasten the day that Jesus returns.
Right?
I mean, it's just sicker than the day is long. And it is kind of hand in hand with a lot of corporate things. And that's one thing that really gets me. How do we change corporate thinking? Because you were saying the other night, in most corporate structures, they say, we'll do whatever is within the law to make profit, right? I mean, how do we get across to them? Because I think they really do think we have a job to just have dominion over everything and make as much money as we possibly can and to hell with consequences. How do we change that? And that's happening on a massive scale.
Well, and you, at least from my standpoint, you hit the nail on the head. Because corporations, especially the large multinationals, have more impact on the world than any of us could have, even if we acted in concert starting today. Tom Friedman, who writes editorials for the New York Times, wrote an opinion piece 18 months, 2 years ago, in which he said, basically, all those nice things that you all are doing, like installing, you know, water control shower heads and, you know, walking to work one day a week and all that kind of stuff, is nice, but it's pointless. And the reason that it's pointless is I came to this place in China that I was at 2 years ago that was completely barren, and there's now a city there. with the population of 250,000 people all wanting to live the American lifestyle. That's corporate effect. And I don't have an answer to how we change that.
But you're the corporate ethics guy.
Well, but my answer is the same that we've talked about in the other two evenings, is it all comes back to us. How many of us have retirement accounts that we want to grow? How do those retirement accounts grow?
Corporate profits.
By corporate profits and dividends. There isn't anything that we can do that doesn't affect everything else. But we've got to be able to start balancing things better than we do. I'm sorry, I'm talking more than I should. I think you were next.
Well, if someone wants to, it's not really a response to that, so you can call me if you want to respond to it.
Yeah, just kind of a response to that. And some of the, one of the things that's always concerned me when I hear talk about population control or blaming population is we've talked about population increases and just economic increases in other countries. In China, the astronomical rate of that cities are just expanding is a scary thing. But I don't really see that. I see that as an escape almost sometimes, that people use it as an excuse to look at China or India or wherever else, because that happened 150 years ago on the East Coast of the United States. And because there were less people, it was okay in that mindset. Or the Nevada, a desert state where people, you have to use an incredible amount of water just to keep your grass green, is the state in the country that the population is increasing the highest.
Las Vegas.
Yeah. I mean, so it's a problem. It's a huge concern. But at the same time, I see it often as an excuse to shift the focus to China, which may be the scarier thing, away from our own problems.
Sure.
In the past.
Sure. We don't have to take responsibility.
My comment is short. If BP isn't a lesson that we can apply as a microcosm and as analogous to what we do with water, what we do with wood, what we do with all kinds of energy, we build out, I'm talking about out from cities, we're further away from the places we work, we build 4,000 square foot houses. If the BP thing doesn't tell us that, and I think I'm jumping on what Rick said at the beginning of the night, doesn't tell us that we can't live this way, we're not looking at the news. Look carefully at BP, what caused it, what our demands force those people or encourage those people to do. Take any risk at all, but I want more oil. I don't give a rip what the risk is, because we want it. And I'm talking, now you give an example of water. BP's got to be a microcosm and an analogy for us in almost every venue of our lives.
Yeah. Well, I think the issue really becomes apparent and becomes addressed when it impacts us personally. When it's our cities that the rising oceans are going to impact, or it's when we can't, or when our energy costs go up. So that can be really the catalyst, I think, for change. Seeing when we're personally impacted, it requires us to personally react, mm-hmm. and to change our own behavior to match the problems that are existing. Because it's so easy to look at the abstracts, like in some of these ideas, but the abstract of population, not only population, not saying like looking at China's population, but just the idea of saying this is a distant cause of the problem, instead of saying, well, my car driving from here to that stoplight is a little piece of the problem.
What's unfortunate about that, I know this is quick, what's unfortunate about that is that there's so much that's going to happen before the Western world is affected.
Yeah.
You've heard all of the statistics. The climate change, oceans will rise. If the oceans rise 1 meter, which will happen, in the next 100 years, 10 million people in Southeast Asia are going to be displaced. What's going to happen, though, is what's interesting is where do those 10 million people go? They're going to be refugees. And there are already military think tanks trying to figure out what will happen with those refugees. You know, and will the United States or the Western world will see the effect of those refugees before they see the direct effects of climate change?
We're officially past time. I'm not encouraging you to go. I'd like to continue the conversation, but it's 9:30. If you want to go, go. You and
I think this really cleanly brings us right back around to kind of your first sentence that our generation can even read back to you, has done an admirable job of screwing up this planet, and it feels urgent that the younger generation fix it soon, help fix it soon. And I guess I kind of said this last night that I'm really encouraged with what is happening at the high school and college level in terms of how this new generation is thinking about the planet, about caring for others. And I mean, I think, so I guess, you know, even though it's like, oh, throw your hands up, I mean, I do feel I have a sick place in my stomach when I see all the BP stuff and you know, you just feel helpless, like, what can I do? Well, what we can do is we can, A, model, you know, walk to work every day, you know, sell a car, you know, I mean, just start eating right, do it right. So, yes, you can model all of that, but we just need, we need to bring all of this to the forefront and allow the brains that are in this next generation to, like you said, fix it. We've screwed it up, Royal. And it needs fixing.
Well, I'm making an assumption that you're related to the guy next to you.
I am.
Well, and he started out the conversation about being amazed that we're unwilling to make sacrifices. Mm-hmm. We're in a situation where if we don't make sacrifices, mm-hmm. we're not going to need to make sacrifices because we're all dead.
There was a campaign at my high school years ago, and we, like, one of the biggest things we focused on was just reaching the people with giving them awareness, but not to the point where they just feel helpless. And I feel like that's a huge problem with the youth today, because they feel like with all the news coming at them and all the things that are happening, it's just like, well, who cares? Like, it's not like anything's going to change at this point, you know? So I think coming up with more of, like, an ideas of change, like figuring out things that we could do differently on a smaller scale would make a huger, a bigger difference. And I don't know, I just think it's overwhelming for a lot of people.
That is also interesting. This book, if you are familiar with Paul Hawken, he's been a crusader for good ecological practices for a couple of decades. But he makes the point in this book that it is an optimistic book, because the point of it, what he's trying to do, is document how many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of social activist groups there are dealing with these kinds of issues, or trying to deal with them. I was looking earlier to try and find the exact quote. I didn't find it. But he makes the statement in there that people, when he gives public talks, people often ask him, well, are you optimistic about the future or are you pessimistic? And his answer is something on the effect of, if you're looking at the future of the planet based on the data that Rick referred to earlier, and you're not pessimistic, you're a fool, or you're deluding yourself. But, which goes to your point, that, you know, if we just look at what's going on out there, it's pretty easy to just give up and say, it's over. But his other point is, because there are so many different groups worldwide fighting to do the right thing ecologically, that he's also optimistic. And I think we need, as we talk about these issues, we need to bring that part of it up as well. You have
I think what you said was really valid, that all of this information can feel totally paralyzing, and you said black cloud earlier, and it starts to spin out of control and you just panic and you don't know what to do, and change is incremental. And this huge problem, we're a fast fix society. We want a fast, proud and you're done. But if we could all do one thing that makes us uncomfortable, start doing one small thing that you're uncomfortable with, pretty soon that will become a normal part of your routine and you'll take one more step and one more step. And if we can just think about it day by day and hour by hour and minute by minute and make those small uncomfortable changes, things are going to start to turn.
Tom, go ahead.
I'd just like to ask Paul to share your example about dandelions. You know what I'm talking about? Is it a radical change?
It's short. We have a big lawn, and we live on the Mississippi River, right next to it, here. And I don't use chemicals on the lawn because they drift into the river and they go down and kill the Gulf of Mexico, which is going to get killed twice now. You all know about that. 5,000 square miles are dead from, you know, nitrates and all that. And so I scoot along on my butt and pull up the dandelions and the crabgrass, and I think I'm pretty noble. But I'm not. If we really want to have a change, we've got to learn to love dandelions. And that metaphor is, it's a whole new paradigm. And we can't ask, that's the end of that metaphor. But we got to quit buying strawberries in December if you live in Minnesota, and et cetera, et cetera. All the stuff that gets shipped, we know it all. We just got to. But I love strawberries, and that's good. But I'm going to quit.
Not giving up coffee. Sorry.
Daddy, Dan,
what?
Not giving up coffee.
Yeah. I think most of us are ready to go, but let me say one last thing that I think is worth thinking about. We've gone from, worldwide, we've gone through several major upheavals, you know, one of them being, the easiest one to talk about being the Industrial Revolution. Huge effects on our society and culture. People moved off the farm into the cities, corporations started, you know, mass manufacturing, all that kind of stuff. We didn't really understand what was going on until well after that had happened. I would like to propose to you that we're in the middle of one of those great cataclysmic changes at this point. And the only thing that I'll say about it is, from the beginning of human history up until this point, our entire focus has been on growth, been on improving our lifestyles, been on getting more, doing more, having more. I think we're at that inflection point where we either change that or we die. Sorry?
I said that. Does anybody know that there's a different way to calculate the economy? These, a couple of young college guys figured. I don't know. I can't
remember. Oh, yeah. They're instead of gross domestic
gross
product.
Domestic, all that stuff, yeah.
I don't know the details. But yeah.
That's not going to be in the stock market.